until something is humbling during the coronavirus.
Hello, this is Joey Page, and I present The Joey Page Show, bringing you the best in new and alternative music on Foo Bar Radio every Wednesday between 2 and 4. But you can listen to it whenever you like, because you're obviously not going anywhere. Make sure you stay at home, stay safe. Why not rearrange that kitchen drawer? Or sort through all those clothes that you've got to work out whether you're going to send to the charity shop or wear again at some point. And all these jobs can be done by listening to the huge back catalogue of my shows and all the other great ones on Foobar. I hope you're staying well. I'm coming to you right now from my evil lair, where I'm working on loads of new ideas for the show and keeping my eye out for all the great new music that's going on. Stay safe. Stay safe, all you cool cats and kittens, and listen to Foobar Radio, keeping you company through the coronavirus.
Marcus Bentley, hello.
Hi, Jim.
My guest today, Marcus Bentley, best known as the voice of Big Brother. Not of Big Brother, because that's other people, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
so you wouldn't be, you're not Big Brother yourself.
I'm the narrator of Big Brother, tier 1 in the Big Brother house and all that jazz.
Yeah, yeah. Do people often recognise your voice? Or?
I try and keep quiet on the streets, really, I stick out, you know, I'm going through London, I stick out like a sore thumb if I see anything, but occasionally, yeah, I see something and people go, oh my God, you're that bloke. It's all, don't see anything.
It's more the intonation of it, really, isn't it?
It's a style, isn't it? So tier 1 in the Big Brother house, last night some of the housemates, bloody blah. Yeah,
I mean, they do all sorts in that house. That's like
we've been going 15 years, so they've done
15 years now.
Yeah.
And how long have you been doing it for 15 years?
Since since July the 12th or the 15th, I can't remember.
Wow,
2000. Yeah,
oh yeah, that's right from the beginning. You got to tell everyone what the Nasty Nick stuff.
That was amazing.
That was
unfolding. Nasty Nick. That was when it really sort of just went mental.
Yeah.
There was a famous DJ, she'll not be named, giving on the radio, on one of the main BBC radios, 50 ways to kill Nasty Nick.
Wow.
I don't think you could do that these days.
No, especially to a man who basically just smuggled in a pen and paper. Like, you know, I think
that was the highlight of the series. Yeah. Basically, why we're still here 15 years later.
But
have we got any music?
We are here to talk about music. We're putting our iPods on shuffle. I'll put mine on first.
You put yours on first.
And then we'll go on to yours next. So let's see what my one throws up first. So here we go. Track 1. I'm here with Marcus Bentley. Is Flipper. No prizes for guessing what the song's called. That's from the album Generic Flipper. Good album. That song, well, good as an album, I'd say. Individual tracks, a little bit hard going, but
what genre would you see that? That's some sort of hardcore punk, but is it not?
Kind of punky indie, indie music. I'd say indie punk, maybe. Yeah, punky indie, but it's a good. Good little, it's a fun little cult album, that is. That's what that is.
Eclectic.
Yeah, yeah. Marcus, I was going to ask you as well, what kind of music do you have on your iPod? Are you,
Well, My favourite band ever is REM.
Lovely.
They're my favourite band Lovely ever. Stuff. And I went to see them, when I was a kid, 84. That was the first time. I didn't know. It was the Newcastle Ballroom. And my mate really liked them.
Yeah.
And he took us, and we went, and I didn't know what to expect. And this bloke came on stage, who was Michael Stipe.
Yeah.
And he had a skinhead.
Yeah.
And he had a hoodie, which was a rip pocket hanging off, and Black Dr. Martens, and I thought he was a roadie, and I just started singing a little weird ditty, and then the band came on, and blew me away. And then we saw them. That I think I worked out once. We saw that was about the October, and then we saw them at Manchester Ballroom in the March, when the Fables of the Reconstruction album came out. And this time he had white peroxide hair, spiky, and he had a velvet smoking jacket on.
Lovely.
It was amazing. And this ballroom in Manchester, sprung floor, and the whole of it was boom, boom. Yeah. It was amazing. So that was one of my favourite gigs I've ever been to. So I love REM.
That's great. You were going to see REM before most people knew who REM were.
I remember I'd been at drama school in about 1990, I think, and they had a really famous album called Out of Time.
Yes.
And that was the album that was really mega.
Yeah.
And I was in this posh street. I was amazed. I had a cup of coffee. And this really sort of middle-class woman and her kids came in, and it was LPs and probably cassettes and the odd CD in those days. And she had an REM Out of Time album there, and I was gutted.
I
was gutted.
It's hard, isn't it?
And then they went mega, about 95, they went absolutely mega with Automatic for the People, and then Monster. They had this tour with where they were supported by Radiohead, all over the world tour. And after that, they slowly fell back into being a cult band again, even though with a mega sort of contract with Warner Brothers. But weren't on everyone's other, a bit like
albums Up and stuff.
Yeah.
Are a bit more,
great tunes. And some of those tunes, if they'd released them earlier in their careers, they would have been as famous as Man on the Moon or whatever now. But
I think my two favourite REM albums are New Adventures in Hi-Fi.
That's one of my favourites.
And Up.
Yeah.
I think those two are the ones we really love.
So they're my favourites. But I love bands like the Pixies. I've got a bit of hardcore on here myself, people like Minor Threat. I love the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about if I could choose one of my songs, I'd choose a Beastie Boy track.
Yeah.
And I remember, I don't cry, but I remember he died the other year, one of the members, it was Coldplay were in concert, and I don't particularly like Coldplay. I think they're great, but there's not something I'd play. And he sang, Chris Martin, live on stage. The Beastie Boy died that day.
Yeah.
Adam Yauch, as he called.
Yeah.
He died that day, and he sang at the piano in a slow, sort of really mournful lilt.
Yeah.
You've got to fight for your right to party. And it brought a lump to my throat. Such a lovely sort of thing. Because they were amazing,
When
they first started, I remember they were just the brats, weren't they? Almost like a comic band, and then they became such a sort of a highly acclaimed.
But they were one of the first bands, the reason why we have parental advisory stickers on stuff. They were one of the first ones that people
their album?
Something like that, I think it might have been that one, where it's like people we need to warn people about this before they buy it, because there was so much naughty stuff.
That was both. 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, it would have been
30 years
more.
Ago, mate.
I think that would have been very long.
I can't do my maths.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, and I love the Pixies like a bit of Killing Joke and a bit of. I was a bit young for all that when it all first came out, but.
Right.
And my mate, I remember going to drama school, my mate was even younger than me, and I'd say, how on earth are you into these things? Because I was too young for these things like The Damned and the Sex Pistols and whatever, but you loved them and.
Well, now you kind of people
the Smiths.
Like,
I guess that was when I was sort of early teenagers. The Smiths and brilliant bands like that. But there's brilliant bands in every era, isn't there? And
Do you want to pass your
book here?
Pass your thing over. We will see what it throws up. I love it if after all that chat, it now just throws up. Oh no, I'm looking at it. I can't see how you put this on shuffle, Marcus. You're listening to FUBAR.
Is it going out? That is. Radiation that haunts dismembered constellations, a faintly glimmering radio station.
Beyond the sun's that guard this roof, beyond your flowers of flaming truth, beyond your latest ad campaigns. An old man sits collecting stamps in a room all filled with Chinese lamps. He saves what others throw away. He says that he'll be rich someday.
The song is called Frank Sinatra. Who's the band?
Cake.
Lovely. And you said you heard that on The Sopranos?
Yeah, I think it was at the beginning or the end, but I imagine it was a fat Tony Soprano walking down the paper to get down the drive to get his paper.
Yeah, you can imagine him walking along to that looking pretty tough.
Yeah.
It was nice. I'd like to make a playlist of songs that are named after other musicians as well. Buddy Holly by Weezer, that would be one that was on there. So I think LCD Sound System did Daft Punk Is Playing at My House. That was a big one.
Well,
I think you can make a whole album based on that kind of stuff.
You got me thinking.
It's kind of it's quite hard, isn't it, when you start properly thinking about it. But I'm sure we could think of more. That was nice, man. Are you a big Sopranos fan?
I love The Sopranos.
See, I've never seen it.
Well, do you know what? A few lads have said that to me lately. I thought, you got to watch it, you know?
Yeah.
All those references you miss in James, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what? That probably finished 10 years ago, didn't it?
Yeah, it would have finished a long time ago.
Yeah.
Who's got time to watch all of the box sets? But that one is one of the ones where you kind of think, I should.
Mind you, it's pretty violent and it's, you know.
I like that kind of stuff. I like a bit of violence.
You know.
Well, yesterday I watched The Purge. Have you ever seen that?
No.
I don't know why I watched The Purge. I've got Netflix and I'm going through it. There's so many options of things that I could watch, and I watched The Purge, which had been given 1 star, but I thought I've always heard of The Purge, and I think it's an interesting idea that it's in a future where there's one night a year where everything's legal. You can do whatever you like.
All I saw that advertised on a bus stop last year.
Yeah, and so you're allowed to kill people if you want, and just what people would do. And I thought I'd watch that. It really depressed me.
Really? Did it deserve more than 1 star?
Yeah, maybe 2 stars, but I'll probably double the star rating. Yeah. Ian Boltzmann.
But Joe, now, you look very like you didn't agree with what I just said, Jay.
Oh, well, I was just thinking about when you said underrated Spider-Man. I thought, that sounds like a nice superhero.
Yeah.
The underrated spider.
Well, you're probably going to write a song about it now. But it was my idea. We're joined by Jay Foreman.
Hello.
Did you not see Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man when he played Spider-Man?
No, I've only seen one Spider-Man movie in my whole life.
What one?
I say the first one, but I'm only going to go as far back as about the early 2000s.
Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, that's the one. The one with the upside-down Spider-Man kiss. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's quite a good movie, but that's enough Spider-Man to, you know, see me in good stead for the next decade or two. And then thousands more came out.
Yeah, no, I think the Andrew Garfield Spider-Mans were underrated. Nobody liked them, but I really liked them.
Why didn't they like them?
Just didn't. Comic book fans just didn't like them. Oh. I thought they were great.
Was it the film or him specifically?
I've got no idea. I don't know, but I actually thought they were good.
Yeah.
And, of course, Tom Holland is doing a sterling job as Spider-Man.
I had an idea for a similar similar superhero to Spider-Man.
Go on.
But basically, he has the power to create a spider web at exactly the same speed and size as a regular spider.
That's nice. Now is that a superpower?
Well, it's a mild superpower. You could use it to make a house look older than it really is.
We couldn't argue that it's a power. That's unarguable. It is a power to do that. Super, I think we're getting into realms of exaggeration there.
It's something that might just come in handy if you need to make a house look older.
Mm. Do you think that? Yeah, but what if you need to make a house look older in a rush?
Ooh. Well, then you'd have to get a slightly different, slightly superhero.
How long does it take for a spider to spin a web?
Have you ever sat and watched a spider spin a web?
I don't think I have.
I don't know. I think it takes all day. It
takes a while.
It's slow, isn't it?
That's awful then, isn't it, when you just go and brush it away?
Yeah, and you feel
there's a spider there just going, fuck.
Yeah.
I feel guilty every time I go into the shed. I'm destroying months of work just to get a pair of scissors.
Just by going in, because you just break it with the door and stuff, wouldn't you? They're idiot spiders, aren't they, really? You'd think that they'd do
it out by now.
Yeah, they keep away from humans a bit and do it somewhere. I think all animals are idiots. Do you agree with that?
I mean, if you had a bar graph comparing the intelligence of animals, yeah.
I think they are really
monkeys
stupid.
Monkeys are all right, aren't they? Quite smart. They can type.
They can type now, yeah.
So they're smarter than us, I think, you know, because they seem to be happier than we are.
Based on what?
Well, I mean, they don't do as many wars as we do. They That's don't do. They don't have mortgages and things that make you sad.
Planet of the Apes.
Oh, you're right, I hadn't thought of that.
That was a stupidly big war, that
yes.
was.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that, I will say in their defence in that one, it wasn't actually their fault. They were they were trying to keep themselves to themselves and humanity was getting in the way and all the, you know, so I agree.
That's a recurring theme, isn't it? Humans bad.
Yeah.
But anyway, how
but
are you?
The monkeys didn't start it, but they certainly were vicious in the war, weren't they?
You'd be vicious too if, you know, same thing happened to you and all your fellow species.
I probably wouldn't. I'd probably sort of keep myself out of the way. That's how I tend to be these days. To sort of keep my head down a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, I think you would do that. You wouldn't get involved.
I wouldn't be involved in on either side.
No, just be in your shed.
In the Planet of the Apes.
No, I don't think you would. I feel like you might be
true.
More on the ape side, though, if anything.
Possibly. I don't know. Do you mean on looks?
No, just in personality.
I think I'd be a wise ape who yeah. would always stay in the village. Do you know what I mean? I'd have my own hut.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other apes would come and tell me what was happening in the water, and I'd go, oh... War not make one grey and stuff like that. I'd just nick it all off Yoda.
Yeah, sounds. I think that sounds good.
But I think
I'd watch that movie.
Yeah, I'd be in it, mate. I'd play myself.
But then I think that movie would be enough to see me in good stead for Planet of the Apes for another few decades.
Yeah, possibly. But I'm noticing a trend then that you're watching a bit of something and going, "That's enough now." Which I think more people should probably do.
Yeah, I mean, look at all the films that come out these days. They're all sequels and prequels and, yeah. and midquels.
Some of them are good.
What's your favourite midquel?
Empire Strikes Back.
Good answer. Have you thought about this?
It's the only answer. It's the only answer.
The only answer.
Not yours, Nat. Don't know what we're on about, do you not?
Well, I don't watch Star Wars, so I'm not familiar with this.
Never mentioned
this
Star Wars.
No one mentioned Star Wars.
Thingies.
I don't know. Dirty Dancing 2.
Okay.
No, that was
terrible. There a Dirty Dancing 3?
I think there was like one with Abigail Breslin. No, that was terrible. Jay, two and three.
There's a midquel I've not seen, but I found the idea really funny. You know the Disney film, The Fox and the Hound?
Right.
And they desperately wanted to make a sequel, but you can't because I think one of the characters dies.
Yeah, yeah.
And
spoiler.
You can't do a prequel either because, you know, they're not born yet. So yeah. They just came up with some sort of Christmassy adventure that they get up to that's, you know, 1 week during the already short timeline of the film.
So it just happened in time. Then they did that with Aladdin as well, I think. Or they did it with Lion King, maybe.
They did Beauty and the Beast, had a midquel, another Christmas midquel. The person you want to talk to about this is Tom Tuck, who's done an entire...
Yeah, he did that show, didn't he?
Yeah, an Edinburgh yeah. show all about poor straight-to-DVD Disney sequels.
Which ended up being, like, nominated for, like, all the awards and all that sort of thing, didn't it?
Yeah, it turns out people really like Disney stuff.
Yeah. Isn't it weird? If you just come up with the right daft idea, you're all
you get
right.
nominated.
Yeah. It's got to be the right daft idea.
Right, yeah.
It's a real sweet spot there.
I had a show at The Fringe some time ago now that lots of people came to in Edinburgh and they said, well, it's such a shame that it's so full of swearing because all you have to do is take the swearing out and it would be a really good
and
kids
it's allowed.
Show.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, actually, that's not a bad idea. And the next year I went back to The Fringe with a show that was very similar but with no swearing and a couple of, like, two or three extra songs written especially for children.
Okay.
And it was the most fun I'd ever had, and it was the best-selling show I'd ever done. So I thought, right, I better take it on tour. And I've now, quite by accident, I've now become a children's entertainer.
Nice. That speaks volumes for you, I think, because I think most comics with, the soul of a comedian, if you're told, oh, no, you should do this, and then it's something like, oh, it should be a kid's show, they go, fuck off.
Oh, I get advice
do you
I refuse
know what I mean?
To listen to all the time,
yeah.
But the kid's show was the one time when someone says, oh, you should do this, because the thing I get more often than you should do a kid's show is, you should write a song about such and such.
Right, okay.
Because, you know, my songs tend to be about the strange everyday things in life and
yeah.
random stuff, for want of a much better word. So people assume, well, I could write a song about just about anything.
Yeah.
Most of the time when people suggest ideas, I don't really want to do it. I had one person say, oh, I've got a bit of broccoli stuck in the colander. Hey, Jay, you should write a song about that.
I said, did you do
nah,
it?
Nah, you're all right. No, I didn't.
I'd have done it out of spite. At that point, I would have done that out of spite. I'd go, yeah, I will write a song about
it. I do sometimes set myself the challenge of taking an idea for a song that is absolutely dreadful and then seeing, can I make it work? Can I make it funny?
Well, is there not something in writing a song from the perspective of... Because if you're writing a song in character, so you're like, you know, with a narrator to the song, or an unreliable narrator sometimes as well. If you're doing that, you could have written a song about the broccoli stuck in the colander, but it could have all been about the person who thought that was hilarious.
Do you know what? Now that you put it to me that way, that's a brilliant idea.
I know, right? I know.
Would you like to do a 50-50 songwriting collaboration partnership?
I'd rather just let you do it. I'm a bit busy at the moment.
Fair enough.
But no, do you know what I mean? I like things like that. Like, that's how you can really give the finger to people saying, hey, write a song like this. Go, all right, I will. And then you just write a song about what a dick they are. I'd be happy to do that. How is it? Do you have any gauge on stuff like that? So when you're in writing mode, do you have a gauge on what's all right and what's not all right? Do you? I mean, obviously, you have it more so now because you're doing a kids' show.
Well, the first test really is if it makes me laugh, and I feel okay. bad because every time I'm sat in a room writing, either on my own or with someone,
yeah,
rather embarrassingly, I often chuckle to myself.
No, that's not.
But that's
you know,
but that's a good test.
A necessity, surely. Yeah.
And the good news is, once I've laughed at my own joke once, I'm spared the embarrassment of ever laughing at my own joke ever again.
Really? See, I'm the opposite of that. I just keep laughing at things. If I said something funny, I will laugh at it forever. It's got to, you know, have longevity in that respect. It needs to probably make me laugh for all that time. So, do you not find kids really annoying when you perform to them?
Oh, they're awful. But I think there's something quite fun about having contempt for your audience when you're on stage. It keeps you going.
Yeah.
And kids, actually, they can be the most exciting audience in the world because they will come up with heckles that you won't be able to prepare for or you won't be able to predict.
You're not allowed to say what you're really thinking.
Exactly. That's why it's good training. You know, being able to deal with child heckles is the same skill as being able to deal with a drunken adult crowd on a Friday night.
But are their heckles as vicious? So are their heckles... Do you ever get vicious heckling from children?
No, I think the worst thing that kids do is they just assume that what they have to say is more important. And my favourite habit that kids do at my shows, there's a lot of interaction in the show, and I say, hey, put your hand up if you've got a suggestion for a thing. And what happens more often than not is a kid will put their hand up straight away, and then when I pick them, they go,
Then they have to think of it.
Yeah.
But they know, I've got to get into the front of the queue for this.
Yeah. But
whatever queue is for.
Even though sometimes the kids can be just unbelievably annoying, the other side of the coin is when the kids love the show, it's so satisfying because kids, they don't pretend to like a show. They won't clap because they have to. They'll clap because they actually enjoyed it, and they'll laugh because they genuinely find it funny. So it can be marvellous.
But is the bar set lower, do you think, for kids?
No, I think...
If you say fart, you're all right. If you talk about poo, you'll be all right.
It's surprisingly difficult. The challenge I set myself in these
shows... I've only done one and I hated it.
Was it with Comedy Club for Kids?
I think it was. It was in Cumbria.
Yeah.
And we did it... It was me and Ed, and we did it in the afternoon. So we... Oh, hello.
Hello.
We did it in the afternoon when we had a tour show in the evening. I think they'd, like, offered us £300 or something. We're like, oh, yeah, we're there anyway. Fuck it, we'll do it. And we did... We used to have a ventriloquist puppet called Naughty Keith.
Oh, yeah.
Whose catchphrase was piss. and I just said to Ed, we'll just go on and do Naughty Keith for 20 minutes. It'll be fine. And we'll just argue about it. You say it's rubbish and I'll say it's brilliant. I'll get all the kids on side with me and that'll be fine.
Yeah.
Until we walked on the stage and I was like, his catchphrase is piss. And I was like, right, well, that's gone straight away.
What was his new catchphrase?
I swear to God, honestly, didn't even think that ahead of time.
Right.
And I felt like that 20 minutes I was on that stage, it really... I never was worried on stage as a stand-up, ever. I never felt off even with it.
Did you not swear at all?
That day?
Yeah.
No.
In front of the kids?
No.
Oh, okay, I'm kind of impressed because you just do, just when you're talking, I would have found the extra pressure.
But I was in character, so we were doing Peacock and Gamble, so it was, so that was all right. It was easier to do that, really.
Yeah.
And because my character in that was so childlike anyway, it was relatively easy to do.
Mm.
The only swearing that I hadn't realised was the piss thing.
It's actually quite easy to sort of switch swearing off. You get quite good at it, and you build up a vocabulary of backup equivalent swear words.
Right.
In fact, I still, like, that instinct has kicked in because we're in a radio studio. Working out what you can and can't talk about that will make the kids bored. It's not stuff that's inappropriate. It's stuff that just means nothing to them. So before I was doing kids shows, I used to do quite a lot of references to TV from the 80s and 90s. And, you know, you can't do that for kids because they'll be bored.
Parents there.
Yes, well...
You can play two audiences,
the fun challenge is to try. My favourite thing is if I do a joke that makes the whole room laugh at once, the kids and the grown-ups, because in real life, there's no such thing as a children's show. It's a family show.
Yeah.
Because the kids will always drag their parents along with them, and the parents have got to sit through it and enjoy themselves just as much. So ideally, some of your jokes will be just for the kids, some just for the grown-ups, but the best ones will be for everybody.
Right.
And that's really hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because grown-ups don't laugh at just saying the word poo.
I would.
Yeah.
What would you do at a children's show, Nat, if you were performing at a children's show? I think I would walk out and say, your parents have asked me here to gash you all.
Access all areas with Joanna Shimonides and Stephen Lang on FUBAR Radio.
We now have Ashley Banjo in now.
Oh, hello. Ashley. Hey!
So how have you been?
I have been good. I am all over the place right now because as we went into lockdown, me and my wife had our second baby.
We saw, congratulations.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much. So, it's been crazy. Like, it's been life flipped on its head for so many reasons for me. But at the same time, like, life is good.
Is it a bit of a weird time to have a newborn?
Yeah, really, really weird. Like, I remember that the nurses saying that babies born in this time period would be called Coronians, right? Yeah. I thought that was pretty cool. Like, so I was like, oh, right, I've got a little Coronian on my hands. And as I'm going to show...
See, you think it's cool, and I was like, oh my gosh, no, how?
Yeah, you sound like my wife. She's like, no, don't give him that name. No. I'm like, no, that's sick. So, no, he's doing really well. But it's weird, man, because he's going to end up being, I don't know, maybe a few months, 3 or 4 months old before that my mum even gets to hold him, which is, we're such a tight family. So for us, that is, it's weird.
Yeah, really weird. And I think there's a lot of people, there's no precedent for this. It's never happened before. So everyone's just kind of feeling their way through it, really, aren't they?
Absolutely.
I guess he's keeping you busy, though. That's the main thing.
Yeah, that's one way to put it.
is he a loud baby? Is he not much of a sleeper?
I'll tell you what, if you've got any people out there that they've got babies that are sleepers, let me know, because I don't think that exists.
Oh, no. And have we got a name as well?
Yeah, his name is Micah.
Oh, I love
that
name.
Nice, it's very cute, yeah.
I've heard of that one, but I like that.
Yeah, he's a good boy. He's a good boy. He's the first banjo with blue eyes, so there you go.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's got blue eyes.
Blue-eyed banjo.
Blue-eyed banjo.
Has anyone in your family got blue eyes, or is it...
My wife's got, like, grey eyes, but obviously, like, we're, like, half Nigerian, so, like, obviously, we've got them, like, dark, them African genes, right? So we've got, like, strong brown eyes. So, yeah, he's kind of, like, first one with blue eyes, which is pretty cool.
That's very cute. So how have you been keeping yourself busy in lockdown? What's been going on, other than being a dad?
Yeah, geez. Just working. We've been, me and the boys launched our new online teaching service called 20DV, which is really cool.
Yeah, tell us a bit about that.
Oh, well, basically, right, with the weekend that we were going to launch it, that's when we went into lockdown. So it was like, great, this is sort of like... Almost a good thing in some ways, because people are going to need something to do, right? But
it's
like the worst timing ever. There's us saying to people, you know, like, here you go, look, here's our new service, come and pay for something new, when people are in all this uncertainty, right? So we continued doing it, kept the project going, put it out there, and made it free for people all the way up until June the 5th. So basically, you can go onto our website, you can learn tutorials, dance with us, and do it for free. So.
That's very good of you.
I definitely will need to be going on that, because I've been trying to do dancing TikToks and I am so stiff. I am so stiff. So I'm going to need to go on that, obviously, to help me out. So you have been doing TikToks as well, which is amazing.
Been doing the odd one. Yeah.
The odd one? They're coming up and I'm like, oh, here we go, another dance one. I'm like, let me try and learn this one. Can't do it. Cannot do it for
shit. So do I come up on your For You page?
Yeah, you come up.
is that a big deal in TikTok? I'm not on it.
Yeah, because we hashtag for it to come up, don't we?
Yeah, it's all about the FYP. It's all about the FYP.
Yeah, that's For You page.
Okay, right, got it. Fine. You could tell I was, the old funny daddy here. I don't know.
Honestly, how are you finding TikTok then? Is that keeping you busy whilst being on lockdown?
Oh, do you know what? I spend too much time on TikTok. I'm not going to lie, like too much time. Like, I wake up and all of a sudden, right, it's not even the time that you spend on TikTok, it's how your brain works. Like, so I'm walking around the house, and then rather than sort of like, I don't know, humming the last thing I heard on Spotify, there's me going, Carol Bayer. But I'm like, what am I doing? Like, I'm humming TikToks.
Do you know what the one that was in my head? You know, like, somebody come get her.
Get her. She's like a stripper.
That one was in my head. And you think, like, a lot of people now are selling all their songs and making the most amount of money from their songs, putting it on TikTok than they are putting it on Spotify and everything else.
Trust me, honestly. So that's the thing. TikTok right now is so real. Like, that's why I love it. Like, it's not shiny. I'm waiting for the day, though, because it will come. I'm waiting for the day that TikTok gets changed up into a bit like Instagram. Instagram now is like, it's not really legit, is it? Do you know what I mean? Like, I love Insta, but it's a bit more fake. Whereas right now, TikTok's super real. That's why I love it.
Yeah.
You've obviously had quite a very impressive career since Britain's Got Talent. How many years ago was it that you were on it?
11.
Jesus, I mean, it honestly seems like yesterday.
Oh my gosh!
What have been your highlights of your time since then?
Oh wow, that's a hard question, man. Do you know what? I feel like one of the highlights is, it might be a bit obvious, but it's still a good one, and that is when I first rolled up, I mean, we've sold it out about three times now, but when I first drove up to the O2 and I saw our name on the banner outside, and I saw like 12,000 people outside queuing. When you walk out at the O2 arena and you know that every single one of those people have bought tickets for you, it's an unreal feeling. Like, you know, you can have a million followers on Instagram, you can be on TV and have 10 million viewers, but walking out and hearing like, I don't know, 12,000 people scream at you for you in that moment, it's unreal, man. And especially like being a dance group, like we're not singers, we don't have music. It's just we're always just so grateful for people's support. It's mad.
No one's ever really managed to recreate the incredible success that you guys have had. Like, what do you think it is about diversity that that really resonates with people?
I think you're looking at it, mate.
Yeah.
No, you know what? I have no idea, man. I feel like we've just tried to keep it real, and we've just tried to be us and tried to be authentic with people. And I feel that, like, whether you're a director on a project, whether you're making tea on a project, whether you're asking for an autograph, whether you're the person giving us a job, we treat everyone the same. Like, and that means we're not just saying that people that aren't important we treat well. I don't treat people who are important special either. I just feel like everyone's a person. So we just try and be good to everyone, try and be the best at our job. And then so far that formula's worked for us, you know?
Yeah. And for you in particular as well, because you also, now you're a judge on Dancing on Ice, you're doing all these other bits involved. Like, there must be a bit of a relief that that finished before before all this kind of happened.
do you know, literally, like, the thought now of, like, going into a room full of hundreds of people and watching people skate around feels weird, right?
Really, really weird.
It feels so weird. But, yeah, I love that show, man. It's good fun.
Do you think you're talking about that? How have you been coping, like, mentally with lockdown and dealing with it?
Yeah. That's the big question. I feel like people have taken it in waves. Like, there were people who were really positive at the start, and then people that dipped and then come back up. Whereas I was one of them. I was at the start, I was like, yeah, this is dope. Like, I'm gonna be at home, like, loving it. And then as it's gone on, like, I feel like it's hit me. Like, and I've gone, oh, the world's changed. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, it's different now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it will forever change. I just sometimes think about, you know, when you go out and you go clubs or you go to appearances or parties.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I'm going to be carrying hand sanitizer gel around me. Like, don't come near me. I'm just going to just
crack
on people. I can't. I wouldn't be able to do it anymore. So I think the world has definitely changed, and I think they're going to keep up social distancing for a while now, I reckon.
I feel like all those people that are going, oh, you know what, a few weeks' time we'll be out on holiday. I'm like, listen, I reckon that you'll be feeling this for a few years.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. My nan said to me recently, well, actually, my nan said to me this morning, we're going to go to Spain in December. And I was like, I don't think you quite know what's going on here.
I don't think you understand what's going on, hon.
I don't think you realise what is going on, nan.
But I think that's kind of the weirdest thing, right? Like, yeah, like the thought that the world has actually changed, and we're living through it at the minute, and we don't really know where it's going.
No.
Like, that's the thing. I feel like that's what's different about this. You know, like, there's always, like, historical events, things that change the course of history. But this has been so quick and has hit the world so hard. And what's unique about it is that we're going through it together, right? So there's not one country that you can run to. Mm-hmm. There's not one place that isn't affected. Like, the world is feeling this. And I think that's what's going to be crazy, like, coming out the other end, like, both from health and economic standpoint. Like, the world's just going to be so different after this.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to see the birth of a whole different type of TV show. Like,
absolutely.
The way that we're connecting and the way that, like, I'm here now. Like, I sit at home sometimes and go, cool, I'm actually grateful for my followers, grateful that, like, I kept up good engagement, because I see people now, like, trying to be like, hi, social media.
And I'm like, I haven't been on for a while. I'm back now.
What up? It works like that. I feel like, you know, you need to build up that kind of interaction over time, right? So I'm really grateful for my followers, man, and I'm really grateful to be able to have that connection, because in some ways nothing's changed. I'm still able to entertain and have fun, whether that be from Insta or TikTok or YouTube. Just not the O2 Arena, is it?
Definitely not the O2 Arena. No, definitely not.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Nick. This is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And we are now joined live at Camp COVID by, well, not live, we pre-recorded on a Wednesday, but everyone knows. Anyway, we're live in the...
I'm doing live brilliant. In principle.
Live on the studio. We're now
live-ish.
We're live-ish. Joined by stand-up comedian legend, Mr. Jason Manford.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm really good. Sorry, I don't know what I pressed there. Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. I'm really good. I feel like I used to be a comedian, and now I'm an IT consultant and a part-time teacher.
How are you... I mean, it's quite a boring conversation by this point, but how are you coping with it, with the current situation?
I'm sort of all right. I just got to keep busy, Nick. Keep your mind busy. I feel all right, really. I mean, because of the kids, obviously keep your day busy, and then I just keep setting myself goals. So we do a stand up thing on a Thursday. I've got some driving gigs. I've got various other things that are going on, but I've not done. Essentially, what I'm trying to say is having the time wasn't the thing that was stopping me doing stuff.
Right.
So that's what I've realised about myself, and I'm slightly disappointed in myself as a human being. I mean, I've done nothing. I've got a mate who's written a book. I've not even read one.
Yeah, I know.
That's not actually true, is it? You've done loads of stuff.
Not as much as I thought. Not as much stuff that I thought I had the capacity for.
Yeah, no. But it is also when you're given. I mean, it's not like it's. In a way, it's a gift. There are positives to be had from
it. Like a dark gift.
But, yeah, it's just like, it is just about making the best out of the situation as opposed to going, well, fine, now I can write my novel, now I can write my screenplay. Obviously, you'd think that in an ideal world you could do that, but essentially, if you can get up and eat and maybe wash yourself every day, that's an improvement sometimes.
Agreed.
I don't have kids.
No.
So you're homeschooling on top of all of this?
Yes, so I have 6 children, Nick. So I've got your share.
That's amazing.
Yeah, 6 kids. And and they're all under 10 as well. They're all 10 and under. So it's full-on homeschooling. I mean, saying that, you know, we're into a system now. I don't know what teachers do all day. We're done for 11. So I don't know how they keep dragging it out to R3, these teachers. Yeah. We're done and dusted.
You've basically got an entire school...
Yeah, I'm off to Ofsted registered just to have them in this house. Yeah, it's pretty full on.
So what do you teach?
I teach all the things. Well, we've just done maths. My daughter's just had a maths meltdown. What's been interesting is finding out how thick I was when it comes to, like, you know, when you're sort of, like, Googling stuff. My daughter's like, are you on the phone? I'm like, no, I'm not. She's like, are you Googling what is an adverb? You know, I'm like, yeah, I am. So I just forgot. It's how quick you forgot everything from when you were at school, because it's not new stuff. Like, these things were all the same things. They've just left you.
I don't think I know that stuff anymore. Like, I think I know what it was.
Yeah.
But like, if you held a gun at my head now, I'd struggle.
Yeah, I know. And yet the brain. Yeah, you could probably sing every single word of the, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air theme tune.
Absolutely.
But everything else has gone. It's mental, isn't it, what your brain's gone. I'm going to keep this.
So we were talking a couple of weeks ago about there being sort of like a spike in the population. I do think that it was kind of like... I do think that at the beginning of all this, I did sort of assume there would be kind of like a cut-off point to lockdown instead of it just sort of like petering out.
I did sort of
imagine there was going to be like, and on, you know, the 5th of whatever, we're all allowed out of our houses, and then there'd be a big party, and then there'd be a huge spike in population. That doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
No. But
do you think that there may be a spike in geniuses... where everyone with kids has had to stay in and homeschool them, and their intelligence is going to skyrocket?
I mean, now I know you've not got kids, because if you think kids are getting cleverer because they've not been with teachers...
Not kids, the parents.
Oh, parents, you mean? OSC.
Parents, Jason.
OSC, no, absolutely not. I mean, even half an hour ago, whatever I was teaching her has gone out of my head. Like, so that is not... No, definitely not. Although I do think there's What will happen is a newfound respect for teachers. Like, I think the complaining to teachers, blaming teachers, all that will have gone. Next time you're in school complaining about something, the teacher can literally go, "Would you want to have a go yourself again?" And you go, "Oh, no, and I'll leave it. No, you're all right, whatever you say."
There will be sort of like a grace period where everyone is so grateful that someone is there to take their kids off their hands.
Absolutely. I'll be stood at the gates for the full 7 hours just clapping.
Oh, well, that's all right then. That's all right. I mean, I've been on my own for most of all of this.
Now you found that then, being on your own?
Fine.
It sounds like a dream, but obviously I can imagine it can be hard at times.
It turns out that I'm fine with my own company, which I didn't realise. It took me a while to... I think I thought, well, I sound like a nightmare, so I better keep busy. And then when you're actually forced to spend time by yourself, you go, I've got to know myself again.
And And what's he like?
He's a dashing kind of guy.
He's nice, yeah, nice fella.
He's got dreamy eyes. And he's just about my height.
What have you done with that time then? What have you? Like I was saying, I've not even read a book. Like, have you read all the books or all the box sets or what have you done?
No, but I'm like a basket case normally. So I've sort of like I spent a month not drinking and working out my brain. My mental health stuff. And then since then, I've just sort of like, I do bits of work here and there. I've been writing music. I'm trying to write lots of TV and dreams, but I find it difficult because it's all self-motivated at the moment because there don't seem to be any sort of like concrete deadlines anywhere.
So, no, I struggle with that, I must say.
I've been like recycling. I've been creating and getting rid of so much recycling. I basically live in a perpetual bottle bank. It's just kind of it's weird. I'm a lot happier than. It's weird because I keep saying that there's two things that are going on. There's an international global crisis where people are genuinely suffering and having an awful time. Mm. And there's also kind of like the thing that you can't do anything about is the fact that you're kind of like we're in lockdown and it's how do you deal with that? And you've got to you can't be depressed about it for 4 months. You've got to sort of be able to make the best out of the situation. Mm. I think that I've just really tried to sort of like.
Well, it sounds like you have.
Well, I've sort of dealt with play. Things that I can deal with.
Yeah. No, I feel a bit like that. I keep saying to myself, you know, I would never have given myself this time off work in my whole career.
No.
You know, I'd have been full on, you know, Tommy Cooper, you know, right on stage, gone. That was always in my head of like, I'll work till the end. And so it being forced upon you, you know, there was a worrisome moment at the beginning where I thought, I'm actually going to have to retrain myself to be a dad and a husband and, you know, a neighbour and all these things that I've sort of, not avoided, but I've sort of not had to do because I've been away on tour or I go, in my head, I think, well, working is the thing that I bring into this family, you know. So, yeah, it's been interesting. And I thought it was going to be a nightmare. The first week, I said to my wife, we have never spent this much time with each other. And she said, we'll be fine. It'll be absolutely fine. Because she's, you know, independent. She's a TV producer. You know, she used to be in charge of lots of people. And suddenly it was just us in the house, these two headstrong people. And I thought, maybe it'll be all right. And then I walked into the kitchen behind her once and she snapped at me. This is like day three. She went, are you following me? I was like, it's the kitchen. This is going to be a long lockdown. And actually, that was the last time we had any weirdness. And it's been an absolute delight.
How do you feel about the prospect of going back to work, though? You can't wait, or are you like...
No, I'm nervous about it. Like you said, it petering out, it's not as if... So I've got a tour... I had a tour cancelled. I was in the middle of a musical tour, and that got cancelled. And then I was sort of off around this time anyway. I booked it off to write and get prepared for the next tour. But after that, I sort of said, right, let's get to... Because the world changes so quickly. I said, look, let's keep stuff in the diary until we have to get it changed. So I'm sort of slightly nervous about going back, but at the same time, yeah, I'm looking forward to it, to actually getting back and doing my job.
I'm sort of like at a point where people are like, do you want to do a gig on Zoom? Yeah. And I'm like, fuck no. But but I guess you have to, because, you know, you can get a bit of money here and there to do it, but it's just like, the Zoom gig's all good. But then it's just like, what? How do you get back to stand-up comedy after this?
It's like, I mean, Mike...
Is everyone going to do a gig? Is everyone going to be doing material about lockdown?
About this, I know. I must say, I did worry about that. I thought, God, am I writing... Cause so I've been doing these online Zoom gigs for the last few weeks now, and it's been lovely just to have something to aim for. I'm only really selling it to my fans, my people who already like me, so I'm not worrying about... You know, what does think in the middle of nowhere? These people are already on Saturday. And it's been lovely. I've got some nice friends in and guests, comics to come in and do a bit. And people get paid to do it. And so it's been lovely. It's been really nice. And it's been nice to write jokes about it. But it's so hard because, firstly, there's not much news other than COVID. So you're looking through the news stuff, you're like, what's happened here? Or some fella in Thailand's stolen a load of flip-flops to have sex with. I reckon I can get 5 minutes out of that, I don't know. Because the rest of it is lockdown, COVID, Boris, Trump. Like, it's the same. It's basically just taken over Brexit. Like, I long for Brexit. I think, oh, I wish Brexit was still in, still a main subject. So could, and I'm not a political comic at all. So it's, I must say, I think it'll be a lot of people talking about lockdown. And what I'm trying to do in the stuff that I'm writing for, I don't want to be doing an hour of... What about banana bread? Like, I don't fancy that.
I don't think people want to hear it either. No. I think at the start of lockdown, there's this idea that it would be impossible to write stuff because who knows what the world's going to be like at the end.
Yes,
whereas actually now, it sort of feels like we're on the second half of it. It does feel like, actually, I think people just want to laugh. And I think that's mainly what it is. And people aren't going to want to talk about it. Talk about anything else. You can probably talk about aspects of it. Like, it's probably funny talking about teaching your kids. People like things like that. Yeah. But I don't think people want to talk about a global pandemic and the...
No. No, exactly. It's your take on what you've been through, I guess. The shared experience.
Back Row and Chill with Noel Clark and Johanna James on FUBAR Radio.
A huge welcome to Kevin McDonald. Welcome.
Hi, I'm in. Nice to be here.
Two-finger clap. So you are the director of Touching the Void.
This is a movie that I made 15 years ago. It was a big commercial hit at the time. It was the first documentary that had made a lot of money at the box office, and for a long time held the box office record, and it won the BAFTA for Best British Film of the Year, and it was a big deal. But one of the things that was nice about it was that it had this fantastic score, a big orchestral score done by a composer called Alex Heffies, and the score for a while got used everywhere in commercials and on BBC Nature documentaries and God knows where. Anyway, so the score was fantastic. And Alex has now organised, I think, a 15th anniversary screening of this film with a live orchestra.
Whoever came up with that idea of being able to watch something with the live music from it, what an experience.
What a treat.
It's an unusual film because it's part drama, part documentary. It's an amazing story. It's actually inspired by or based on a book which was written by this man, Joe Simpson, who this amazing adventure happened to, which the film is about. He and his friend, they were like 20 and 22, and they wanted to be the first to climb a mountain in the Andes called Sula Grande, and they set off with this crazy plan. We're going to climb this mountain that's defeated everybody else who's ever tried to climb it. They battled their way up through storms and terrible ice flows and whatever else you get on mountain size. It's about 21,000 feet, so super high, very high altitude, and they got to the top, and they were the first people ever to get there. It took them 3 days to get up, I think. Turned around to come down, and Joe fell and broke his leg. And his mate, Simon, who was with him, had to decide, you know, am I going to try and get him down? I mean, it's such an incredibly precipitous, difficult mountain. I'm 20 years old. What do? Do I leave my friend here or do I take him down? So he tries taking him down, luring him down on a rope. Storm comes in. It's terrible weather. And he lures him over a cliff. And he can't pull him back up. And the rope's not long enough to let him down to where the bottom of the cliff is. And he holds on. And eventually takes out a knife. And he cuts the rope on his friend and sends his friend to his death. But, of course, he's not dead. He falls to the bottom of the mountain, miraculously hits some soft snow, goes through into a crevasse that's like 100 feet deep, and is sitting at the bottom of this ice cave there, abandoned by his friend. His friend thinks he's dead. And it's the story about that and about how that guy survives.
Oh, my goodness me. I literally realised I had my mouth open that whole time.
That scene where you filmed it, where he's crashing through, at the time I was very young, and for me it was very iconic, and it was actually one of the scenes that it engrossed me a lot and actually sort of developed my interest in film a lot, especially the documentary side of things. But I had never seen it being switched between sort of the drama and documentary. The realism of it and the themes of like trust and friendship and and you really filled those gaps massively with everything that you need to make it. Well, obviously, you won the BAFTA for it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. No, it was at the time, it was a big risk, actually. It seemed like a big risk because often that thing where you get dramatizations, you get interviewees or, you know, documentary, and then you get drama. It never really works, and so I was very nervous about it, but I think we pulled it off. I mean, certainly from the perspective of 15 years ago, it seemed like we pulled it off. The story is fantastic, and it is one of those stories that sort of grips you by the neck and doesn't let you go until you get to the end. And if you don't know the story, you're going to be...
I mean, that is a predicament. If you're talking about being in a pickle, that is a pickle
that
of a situation.
That is the definition of a pickle.
And I'd be having strong words if that was my mate. Right, let's just address the whole knife over a cliff rope thing, shall we?
Ian Boltzmann.
We have author Anthony Horowitz is in the studio.
We were going through earlier on the stuff that you've done. Mm. Nat said you made up Midsummer Murders, which
did.
Isn't true.
I didn't know this.
I did create the TV series.
Did you create it?
Yeah, I did. Look, there was a series of books by Caroline Graham. They were called Agatha Christie on Acid. They were terrific thrillers.
Okay.
And somebody came to me and said, will you do a TV series based on these books? We're going to call it Barnaby. And Barnaby, of course, is the name of the detective in there. And yeah. I said, I read the book, and I saw a couple of the books, and I said, look, the hero here is not the detective, it's the place, that's what this is all about. Call it Midsummer Murders. So I did actually put those two words together, and then when it came to writing the original sort of first seven double episodes, because they were 2 hours long, I sort of crafted the show as well.
Okay.
Which is, you know, so I do get a sort of created by, in small letters, I think, because you know, well, there are other people. There was a producer, there was Caroline Graham, and yeah. So, but I was very much there at day one.
Well, then I apologise, Natalie.
Yeah, because
for making trying to make fun of you.
Yes, he wasn't.
When it transpired that what you said was actually technically true.
Yeah.
Toby, you're still a prick.
And Foyle's War.
That Foyle's War was all my own work. That and my wife, Jill Green. Jill Green was a producer on that show, and she and I have been married for a long time and have worked together on lots of shows together. And we came up with that idea in about 1999. After I left Midsummer Murders, I stopped writing Midsummer Murders, got fed up with just the amount of death I was sort of putting into the scripts, and decided to try and do a whodunit. This really is the beginning of all my sort of career where I am now. The idea was, could a whodunit be something more than The Butler Did It?
Yeah.
If you read, you just said that's a big chunky book there, 300 pages of the sentence is death, for example.
I meant in surface.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's still the same point. If you're going to give up 2 or 3 days of your life to read that book, you want something more at the end of it than The Butler Did It or The Dentist
Understood.
Did It or The Doctor Did
okay.
It. So Foyle's War was an attempt to do just that by moving it into the Second World War and telling stories that nobody knew about 1940 to 47 and what was happening in this country and all the extraordinary things that happened. And at the same time, yes, there were murders, but they weren't sort of the most important thing in the book.
Okay.
So that was the beginning of the sort of the later part of my writing.
How tired do you get?
Never. I don't get tired.
Do you really not?
Not.
Do you write all the time? Do you?
I write all the time. I love writing. I mean, just like, you know, how long do you spend in the studio a day, two of you together?
I do it once every two
once
weeks.
Once a fortnight,
so
he's in here
for
four,
hours.
4 hours. And then on a daily thing, it can be 3 hours, it can be 2 hours.
Sorry,
it's not...
I thought you were going to answer 12 hours a day.
No, I begrudge every second.
I love what I do. I love writing. I love writing mysteries and thinking up clues and murders and suspects and beguiling people and tricking people. You know, so far, nobody who's read the sentence is death has guessed the ending. And to me, that puts a big smile on my face. All those hours plotting it and thinking about it and layering it with the different sort of suspects and red herrings and all the rest of it has paid off. And so it's just, you know, to me, it's not 10 hours a day or 12 hours a day. It's just the moment. I just love every moment of it. So
just
I didn't even notice
doing,
time
yeah.
passing.
That's incredible. That's when I guess you know you've hit your calling, isn't it, really?
I
guess
I knew from the age of 10. I mean, I started writing when I was... I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was at 10-year-old boy in a horrible school in North London, a boarding school, sort of having a miserable time.
Did you knew you could do it, though? Did you know?
I learned it because at the school, which was a boarding school, I used to tell stories to the other kids in the dormitory to sort of cheer them up. And everyone was depressed. It was a horrible, abusive place.
In North London,
their lawyers have attacked me, saying if I ever, you know, mention their name without saying, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
it's a
real
duty of care, doesn't it? No boy bad mouthing the school. They don't worry about the experience I've had.
Yeah.
They do worry about the sort of fact that I might land them in it. Anyway, you can find it out easily enough on just put my name in and prep school, and up it will pop.
Right.
And I'm sure it's a lovely place now.
I'm sure it's a wonderful
school right now. But then it wasn't. And to cheer the kids up, I told stories. And in that moment, I stopped being the sort of the tubby, useless, unpopular, always in trouble kid and became the storyteller.
Okay.
And at that moment, I found my calling.
That's an amazing thing, I think. And then to see that through... How old are you now? Do you mind asking?
I'm 63. It's terrible.
Are you 63?
So old. If a little kid I was then could see a 63-year-old man sitting in this studio talking to you about, what, my 49th or 50th novel, he wouldn't believe it. I mean, I still find it incredible that, you know, that I've been going so long and that I've reached this age. It's not great, to be honest with you. Turning 60 was a bit of a shock to the system.
Well, you don't... On looks, you don't look it, first of all.
Well, that's nice.
You genuinely don't. I'd have said, like, sort of maybe late 40s, early 50s.
Well, I'm very happy to hear it. Although, actually, having said that, one of the funny things is that these days I don't care anymore, you know.
Yeah.
You get old and you realise that the world belongs to other people, to you know, for next generation, and that you have a certain amount of time left. I try and work and, you know, do good work still and, you know, still surprise people and myself with the writing I do. But at the end of the day, I'm very comfortable with the age I am. It's a funny thing. When I was in my 30s, in fact, in my 30s and 40s, that was when I was getting twitchy and worried. When you know, when you have kids and you start realising that you're losing your freedoms in life. And you know, little funny things like, you know, if you get really pissed at night that you're going to pay for it the next day, which you didn't do before, suddenly, you know, a hangover, you know, stays with you. Little things like that get you really paranoid and worried about getting old. But when you actually do get to the point where actually you can't really disguise your age and don't even try to, I mean, you know, Botox or haircut, all that sort of stuff.
He was going to say long hair then, wasn't he? He looked at me and was going to say long hair. And then
long. People don't grow their hair long to disguise their age. They do have implants, they do have dyes.
I do
to
disguise our fat
faces. I noticed your beard is going, actually, a very sort of, you know, distinguished
shade of grey,
which is looking really good on you.
Well, did you know what? I've got the same thing with age, though. I love getting old. Like, I properly do. I really like it.
Have you got kids or any of that stuff?
No, nothing like that at all. No, not at all.
Well, I think that's what ages you more than anything else in the world, is having kids. I mean, that's...
I'm not
but
going
again,
to.
You know, age is a... they said this, age is a state of mind, and I never want to be sort of grumpy and old and sort of, you know, and set in my ways. Well, I think that, you know, God, it's all clichés. So how can you talk about age without talking in clichés? Mm. You're only as old as you feel, all that stuff. It's true.
But when you... what I would imagine must feel very satisfying is when you say there, what's it, 49, 50 books, when you look back at your legacy already, so even... as a still living author, your legacy already is only going to get larger.
I think what's great is not so much looking back. I try never to look back, because one of the things in my life is I don't look back. Okay. We look forward. And I think what's good is that, quite honestly, my books are getting better. And I think that's the most important thing. If you're going to keep writing and be a long-distance writer, if you're going to keep doing what you do or what you do, you know, the thing is, as long as you're getting better at it or certainly not getting worse, I think that's what matters. And to me, writing has always been an adventure. And I think that, you know, trying to write books that haven't been done before, ideas that have never been done before, and surprising people with stories that will, you know, not just beguile them with who did it, but actually make them smile, go, you know, how did you think that up?
Yeah.
To me, that's the fun of it all. And fun, actually, is the biggest and most important thing in a writer's life. I spend a lot of time on my own. I spend a lot of time, you know, just in a room writing, and therefore having fun and making sure that there's always a smile in it matters.
Yeah. You make me feel guilty.
Why? Because you're comedy. You're a comedian.
I don't do stand-up anymore, but I've got I think abnormal work ethic. I think my work ethic is really good, like really good.
Meaning what?
Meaning I work every day and I work hard every day.
And when you're not here, what do you do?
I do podcasts, I write, I've just made a film off my own back.
Wow.
Which we just put together, you know, we just found funding and put it together and made
amazing.
It ourselves. So lots of different things. And I have a Patreon page that I put stuff on every single day, which is, it's a self-funding thing. Uh-huh. So it's the thing I put stuff on, the stuff that I'm working on every single day. And it knackers me. Look, it really does exhaust me, because you've got to do the stuff as well. But I still feel like I've not found the rhythm yet.
Harriet Rose on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to FUBAR Radio. I'm Harriet Rose.
Welcome to Nina Las Vegas.
Hey. How are you, babe?
I'm very good. I do think you're always in a privileged position. I bite. Like, when someone says something really shitty or dumb about women in music, like, I fight back. But I do, because I have, like, 10, 12 years of experience and, like, I guess a legacy in a weird way.
You do have a legacy.
To be
100.
Able to say that. So, like, you know, I called out... This American Vogue posted last Friday, and they just posted a whole bunch of males that put out music on Twitter, and they're like, great day for music, like Tiesto, Weathen, like, you know, all these kind of big white males in EDM, and it was like 10, and they wrote, who did we miss? And I just couldn't help. I was like, you miss women, like, you know, then, and then they hit me back straight away. You can see it on my feet, I don't care, but they're just like, we, you know, when it's not intentional, we don't consider gender a thing, just you tell us. They got so defensive.
Yeah, but that's, you know, when only the reason that people get defensive is because they're wrong.
They know they're wrong. And I just wrote back, I was like, hey, I send you music all the time, run by women. You write about it sometimes, thank you. But it is not my job to balance your lineup.
No way.
Hate that when that's, you know, like, it's just so, I refuse to talk about problems that aren't mine anymore. The problems are the promoters, the problems are, the, like, if you want to be a male DJ or, you know, identify as male and get on a lineup with 10 other males, enjoy your fucking night. Because to me, that sounds like a jock horror film. So if you want that, cool. But, like, it's not sexy. It's not a sexy lineup.
Yeah.
It's not going to make, like, girls engage in a way that female DJs can make women engage. It's not going to engage in a way that you will come out and go, that was cool, I learned something. It's just going to be repetitive and the same, and you're going to encourage 30 guys at the front, like, fist pumping. So if you want that, go for it. What? Not my problem.
Stay home and chill.